In just a moment, enjoy the All-American Sports Show. First, we'd like to remind you that weekdays, this NBC station entertains you royally. For quiz, there's a trio of top shows, Red Benson's Phrase That Pays, and our two newest additions, Second Chance and It Pays to Be Married. There's great comedy with Bob Hope, interesting guests with Dave Garraway, and Tommy Bartlett's Welcome Travelers. Also, the accurate reporting of NBC's Pauline Frederick and Morgan Beatty within the News of the World. Right now, it's the All-American Sports Show on NBC.
The All-American Sports Show with Joe Hassan. From NBC New York, the All-American Sports Show, a new series of colorful, dramatic stories dedicated to those figures in the world of sport who have captured the imagination of all America. Tonight, from out of the past,
the story of Todd Sloan, one of history's most colorful jockeys, the man who won fame on two continents and whose career was over when he was 26.
And from the present,
another great jockey, the man in the saddle when Green Tree Stables' great horse, Tom Fool, goes out to win, Ted Atkinson.
And here to tell the stories, NBC sports reporter and sports fan, Joe Hassel.
They call horse racing the sport of kings. But here in this democratic land of ours, it's also the sport of the man on the street. Tonight, I'd like to tell you about several figures who have added color and drama to turf history. I'm sure you've all heard the song, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, over and over through the years. It was written by the greatest song and dance man of them all, George M. Cohan. It swept the nation back at the turn of the century, and we've been singing it ever since. Chances are you know it by heart or think you do. Maybe you wonder what it has to do with horse racing, but listen a minute.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, a Yankee Doodle do or die. A real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. She's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride a pony. I am a Yankee Doodle boy.
Now let me ask you this. Did you ever notice those lines, Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride a pony, I am the Yankee Doodle boy? Well, what do you think they mean? How did that get in there? Let me tell you about the Yankee Doodle boy who went to London just to ride the pony. Out in Kokomo, Indiana, toward the turn of the last century, a kid used to hang around the harness shop and the livery stable and look at the sporting prints of famous jockeys and their steeds. He was an orphan kid who lived with strangers. Maybe because he felt friendless and lonely, he made friends with horses. He ran away from home and worked with a show that toured the county fair circuit. When he saw the horse races at those county fairs, he felt the thrill of the bright silks, the roar of the crowd, and the thunder of hoofbeats. Because he was a little chap, they gave him a chance to ride, and he also worked as a stable boy. As they traveled from track to track, he slept in a straw bunk in the freight cars. And as the horses stirred in their sleep, he dreamed of gleaming boots, of the flashing silks of famous stables, and of standing in the winner's circle. He finally drifted to San Francisco, and there he suddenly became a riding sensation. Almost overnight, little Todd Sloan became the most spectacular rider in racing history. He became the favorite of the rich stable owners, the darling of the aristocrats who came to the fashionable tracks, the friend of Broadway celebrities like Diamond Jim Brady, Bet a Million Gates, and Pittsburgh Phil. He won fame and a fabulous fortune. Then in 1897, Todd Sloan looked for new worlds to conquer. Yes, Todd Sloan went to London just to ride the ponies. He won 21 straight races, and now he hobnobbed with nobility. Just 5 feet tall in his high-heeled boots and weighing less than 100 pounds, he cut quite a figure in his striped trousers, cutaway coat and gray topper. He had a fling at the French tracks and took Paris by storm. Then, when he was just 26 years old, at the peak of his career, a very strange thing happened.
The English Jockey Club regrets to inform you that you're no longer permitted to ride on English treks because of conduct prejudicial to the best interests of racing.
Yes, he was suddenly barred from the tracks in a mystery that's still unsolved. He came back to America, where his popularity was so great that George M. Cohan wrote a musical comedy about an American jockey who became the rage of London. But even as people were singing the song he had inspired, Todd Sloan found that he was barred at tracks all over the world. Yes, his fabulous career ended when he was only 26, but the legend lived on. His fame and his fortune disappeared, and once again he drifted, as he had once drifted from track to track as an eager youngster. But now there were no dreams of fame and fortune along the way. The trail led to California, where a few old friends helped him out when they could. And he was 59 years old when he died there in 1933, with the days of his glory long forgotten. But perhaps you remember the thrill of the flashing silks, the thunder of pounding hoofs, the cheers of the crowd, and the song about a Yankee Doodle Boy. That's the story of a great jockey of the past. And now for the story of a great jockey of today. He didn't seem to be headed for a career as a rider, but still fate and his own determination seemed to conspire to make him one of the great ones of our day. And his career reflects the success and disappointment, the glory and the heartaches that make horse racing what it is. He grew up in the town of Corning in upstate New York, one of a family of 8 brothers and sisters. His name wasn't important then, as he went to school and did odd jobs to help out with a family budget like many another youngster. He did just fine in high school. Got himself a scholarship to go on to college, and that's just where he wanted to go, except that it was 1932. And if you were one of a family of 8 kids, maybe you needed to go to work instead. Work? It was a little different in those days. You were looking for the jobs. They weren't looking for you. So the youngster went down to the glass factory in Corning and had a little talk.
Any kind of a job, mister. I don't care what it is.
Son, there isn't a job around here that would fit you. I mean that you could do.
I said I'd take any kind of job.
The only open thing is heavy work, and I mean real heavy work on the furnaces. We look for pretty big men on those jobs.
What's size got to do with it? Listen, mister, I can lift twice my weight and keep on lifting it. I can swing a shovel with the best you got, and I need this job.
I hate to turn down a kid with your spirit. I'll tell you right now, it's too much for you, son, but if you want to find out for yourself, head for the furnace room.
So this slender little chap took the hard, hot job of firing a furnace in a glassworks. The kind of a job that can make the toughest man ache for quitting time. When his folks moved to Brooklyn, he got another job as a laborer for a chemical company, where he loaded heavy cases of a bleach solution onto tracks. He's often been kidded about his size, but now he met a husky truck driver who was kidding on the square.
Okay, take it away.
Gosh, kid, those cases must weigh twice what you do.
Watch out. Here comes another one.
Hey, take it easy, will you? No kidding. What do you weigh?
What difference does it make if I can do the work?
Oh, I don't mean that. I just mean you got a lot of moxie for a little guy. You know what? You ought to be a jockey.
That's what everybody says. It's a pretty corny joke to me.
No, I'm on the level. Now, there ain't many guys your size as strong as you. Did you ever think about it?
Sure, but I don't know anything much about horses.
Well, look, I know a guy who rides for Green Tree Stables, a guy named Silvio Gucci. Ever hear of him?
Nope. I guess I don't know much about racing.
Well, maybe I could fix it up for you to see him. He might be able to do something for you.
Would you do that, Mac? Sure might be worth a try. That's one thing, sure.
Okay, I'll give you a letter to the guy. Who knows? You might be a hotshot jockey, and then I can get some inside information.
The boy found the truck driver's friend at Belmont Park. He found him in one of the stables, and for the first time, he was behind the scenes at a racetrack.
What do you think, Mr. Coochie? I'd sure like to try.
Gee, I don't know, kid. You got the build all right, and you look like you got the hands. But you're kind of old to start trying to be a jockey. How old are you?
20. I'm just 20 years old.
Most guys start out when they're just kids, maybe 14, 15 years old. Well, if you want to give it a try, come over to the cottage. We'll see Lee Cotton.
It was a job, all right. $20 a week in food. And it meant getting up early in the morning, cleaning out the stables, exercising the horses, cleaning the tack, and doing anything else they could think of. He was scared at first when he galloped the horses in their morning workouts and when he was asked to break in yearlings. A thoroughbred horse is big and strong. He's keyed up and high-strung, and sometimes he's wild and mean. The boy dreamed of riding in a race, but he slowly came to realize that they had too many star jockeys for him to have a chance. But he was determined now that he could make good, and that meant another tough decision, one that he could only make after talking to his father, who had made his own tough decisions in his time.
Dad, I'm in this business to stay. I know it isn't easy, but I haven't found anything else that is either.
Well, what do you want to do, son?
Well, if I stick around the East and the big stables, I'll never be anything more than an exercise boy. They got jockeys to spare and good ones, and I'm not young as jockeys go. The thing for me to do is head out west and ride the small tracks. Take a horse wherever I can get him. Build up experience.
Sounds like a fine way to get killed.
That's a chance you take.
Yeah, but what's the future in it? A few years of a little money, and then you're a man who was once a jockey.
Dad, a fourth-rate jockey can make $5,000 a year if he keeps his head. He can go right on making it if he knows his business. I don't intend to die broke.
Well, you've always been a serious boy. If you think you can do this and put money in the bank, I'm for it.
He went west, and he rode for the gypsy owners, the kind of owner who travels from track to track with just a couple of horses, hoping to win enough to pay the feed bill. There were rough tracks where your mount could stumble and fall. There were second-rate horses and bad actors you couldn't trust. And there were the older guys who ganged together to block you off. There were tough kids coming up and desperate old-timers on the way down. And they were all riding to win, and they didn't care how. But it was a good way to learn. And one spring day at Beulah Park at Columbus, Ohio, he rode his first winner.
The winner, Musical Jag by a length, Ted Atkinson up.
Now he was a full-fledged apprentice on his way to being a jockey. But even as Ted Atkinson rerode that race over and over in his mind, he never dreamed of what was ahead for him. The next summer, he was sent to the North Randall track near Cleveland, Ohio, by the famous Calumet Stables. By now, he was making $90 a month, but he was beginning to win more and more often. He was no longer just an exercise boy, but he still went to the track early in the morning. He worked with the horses, and he talked with the trainers, trying to learn all that he could. By this time, he'd been knocking around from track to track for several years, and he figured he was a pretty tough little guy, able to take care of himself. And he was, up to a point. North Randall was the point where destiny struck. Destiny in the form of a girl. As one of the other jockeys put it...
You just take your eyes off that, Ted. That just happens to be the mayor's daughter.
I saw her last night. One of the nicest people I've met in my life.
Yeah, but she's not our kind. They're a big trotting family.
Girls are a dime a dozen, but women are mighty rare in this world. I'd change my life for one like that.
You'd have to. When you get back to your rooming house, you just look out your window. And that 28-room stone house you see in the middle of that 100-acre patch, that's where she lives.
I got a feeling she'd live in a tent if she made up her mind it was the right thing to do.
Ted Atkinson was right about the mayor's daughter. Her name was Martha, and after time she had plans of her own about being a jockey's wife. And she came in for some very sound adult advice.
Now, look here, Martha. You know perfectly well that I've got nothing against this boy. I like him. He's the only jockey I ever knew that's read more books than I have. But hang it all, he's not for you.
I know everything you have to say. I've gone over it all. But it hasn't changed my mind.
Have you thought of the cheap hotels you'd be stuck in, the rooming houses, the dreary trains and buses you'd ride in, the kind of company you'd keep?
I'd be in his company. That seems to be all there is to it.
Well, it isn't. Do you know how long the average jockey lasts in this country? About 3 years. What do you do after that?
Well, he isn't going to be through in 3 years, nor in five either. I don't gamble, you know that. I wouldn't bet on a horse because I don't believe in it. But I bet on Ted Atkinson.
In the years that followed, racing fans learned the same thing. They learned to bet on Atkinson almost regardless of what horse he was riding. Many jockeys have a few seasons of blazing success and then disappear. The strain and the tension and the constant struggle to stay in perfect condition is too much for them. But Ted's success came more slowly as he improved season by season. With Martha beside him and then with the birth of a baby daughter, he had more reason to show what he could do than ever before. They traveled from track to track and lived in hotels, apartments, and boarding houses. And wherever they were, it was home, because Martha sent her husband off to work in the morning and then looked after her own job. Their friends were mostly other jockeys and their wives, but she and Ted lived a little differently.
I just came by to see if you wanted to go to the track, Martha.
Oh, thanks, Betty, but I have too much to do.
Wasn't Ted riding today? I thought he had the favorite in the fifth race.
Oh, he's riding, but I'm not sure just what horses.
Well, I can't be late. My Johnny's riding in the first race, and I'm always there when my husband's in a race.
Well, you better go along then, Betty. And have luck, but not when Ted's riding.
All right. If you want to go tomorrow, just call. I'd be glad to drive you over.
Well, as a matter of fact, I almost never go to the track. You see, Ted takes care of the racing, and I try to take care of the house.
Oh, I know, but you've got to get out and around some, honey. We're going to meet Alice and Herbie later. Why don't you come along and we'll all have dinner together? It's a wonderful place not far from town.
But I already have a roast in the oven. When Ted gets home, he wants dinner right on time.
I just don't understand it. When Johnny's riding, I just can't keep my mind on anything. Don't you worry about Ted, about whether he wins or whether he loses or whether something happens to him?
Doesn't do any good for me to worry about that. I guess I worry more about whether he eats the right things and gets to bed on time.
There's something about the excitement of the track, its quick changes in fortune, and the promise of easy money that sometimes gets into your blood. A lot of jockeys live with a recklessness that seems part of their profession. But Ted Atkinson planned in life as carefully and coolly as he planned a race. He paced himself slowly, spending year after year on the New England tracks, while more spectacular jockeys took the headlines. It was 3 years before he won his first big stake race, the Massachusetts Handicap on War Relic. A few years later, he rejoined the Green Tree Stables, where he'd been an exercise boy. Now he was riding good horses in top racing events, and fans began to take notice. At the end of a race, one turned to another.
Well, there's another loser. How'd you do?
Okay, won the place money.
What kind of a system do you have? You're always in the money.
System? Man, I don't even read the racing form. I just bet on Ted Atkinson.
And I go broke figuring things out with a slide rule.
I'll tell you something about that guy. He never gives up on a horse. If he can't win, he's still booting to place a show.
In 1948, after 10 years on the track, he was the top jockey of the year for the second time. He'd gone to post more than 10,000 times, had won more than 1,500 times, had collected more than $5 million in prize money. But that year was more important to him for another reason. He and Martha moved into the kind of home they'd always wanted. Not a mansion, just a beautiful old colonial house in a quiet Long Island suburb. But the next year, 1949, looked like an even bigger one. He had a great 3-year-old named Capot to ride in the Kentucky Derby, a race that he'd never won. The favorite was Olympia, with Palestinian a dangerous contender. But Atkinson had a plan. As one of the greatest crowds in racing history watched, they battle around the last turn into the stretch.
It's still Olympia in the lead, but now Atkinson on Capot is making his move. Palestinian made a challenge, but he can't make up the distance. Atkinson has been concentrating on Olympia all the way. Coming into the stretch now, it's Olympia by a head. They're neck and neck, and now Capot goes ahead. Olympia's fading badly as Capot leads. But here comes Ponder, an outsider. Capot is tiring, and Ponder is coming up. And it's Ponder coming from way back to win by 3 lengths.
Mm-hmm. Atkinson had ridden his race. He'd killed off Palestinian and pushed Olympia into too fast a pace, then made him quit. That was the plan, but it went astray as a long shot came out of nowhere. But there were no excuses. Atkinson went on to win the Belmont and the Preakness Stakes on Capote. Went on to ride so brilliantly that Capote was named the Horse of the Year. But still, the broken dream of winning the Derby lived on. In 1950, his hopes were stirred again when he visited the Green Tree Farms in Aiken, South Carolina, and saw a two-year-old that caught his eye. Back up north, he told his friends,
"Well, you can never tell about a horse, especially a two-year-old, but I like this one."
"You're not a guy to tout a horse very often, Ted. What's his name?"
"They call him Tom Fool. If they mean a fool for speed, I think they're right."
"Sounds interesting. When are you going to see him?"
"He'll be running at Saratoga, and I'll be on him in his first race."
Tom Fool won that first race at Saratoga, went on to win four more races that year as a great two-year-old. In February of 1952, with the Kentucky Derby 2 months away, Atkinson won the Santa Anita Derby on a horse called Hill Gale. And after the race, Hill Gale's trainer came to talk with him.
"Ted, I know you're under contract at Green Tree, and I suppose you'll be up on Tom Fool for the Derby. But just in case anything goes wrong there, you've an open invitation to ride Hill Gale."
"Well, that's a very kind offer, sir, but I guess you better figure out another jockey. When the Kentucky Derby rolls around this year, I'll be there on Tom Fool."
Tom Fool was his horse all the way. And Tom Fool came through for him by winning a race at Jamaica a few weeks before the Kentucky Derby. But then, just 2 weeks before the big race, Tom Fool was stricken with a virus infection.
"I'm sorry, Ted. There's not a chance he'll run in the Derby."
"You sure, Doc?"
"Positive, Ted."
"Oh, that's tough. He's such a great horse. Seems he ought to get his chance."
"It's a little tough on you, too. There goes your chance to win the Derby."
"I guess that's all part of the game. You know, it sounds silly, but I couldn't feel worse if it was my own child."
Derby Day came at Churchill Downs with all of its colorful pageantry. As the horses paraded to the post, Atkinson was there on a horse named Gushing Oil. The same old excitement swept the crowd as the horses pounded toward the finish line.
"They're coming down to the wire, and the winner is Hill Gale. It's Hill Gale all the way. Subfleet was second, Blue Man third, then Master Fiddle, Count Flameros, Happy-Go-Lucky, Hannibal, Cold Command, Smokescreen, and Gushing Oil was last."
From far back on an also-ran, Ted Atkinson watched the horse he might have ridden to victory in the Kentucky Derby. He might have won the only big race he had never taken. For 2 months, Tom Fool stayed away from the races, but then gradually began to get well. Last August, he was shipped to Saratoga, back to the track where he's won his very first race. Ted Atkinson felt more than the usual tension as they entered the starting gate, but Tom Fool proved his class and courage that day. He came back after illness to win and to keep on winning. This spring, Tom Fool and Ted Atkinson came back to the races with half a dozen straight victories. And right now around the stables, they're arguing about whether Tom Fool is the greatest horse running today. Next Tuesday, when another racing meet is on at Saratoga, Ted Atkinson and Tom Fool will be there again, ready to show what they can do. Ted Atkinson doesn't say much, but when he speaks of Tom Fool, you know, this is the horse he's been looking for ever since he first came to the track, determined to be a jockey. That's our tribute to America's great jockey, Ted Atkinson.
You know, Joe, I just heard you say something about next Tuesday's race. Maybe it's going to be Native Dancer against Tom Fool, Eric Guerin against Teddy Atkinson. Fabulous names in racing. Kind of took me back. I've been watching the races a long time. Back to the fabulous 20s and the famous names of that time. Jockeys, people who owned horses. And if I think of a jockey, I can think of only one back in the 20s, Earl Sandy.
Why, you couldn't have made a better pick, Ray. You know, Sandy actually got his racing start as a youngster in Idaho. His Norwegian father and American mother moved there from North Dakota. Earl had two sisters and a brother, and they lived on a little farm outside of American Falls.
And that's where he got his first horse.
That's right. He traded $15, five live ducks, and a brand new bike for a calico pony.
And he rode in all those local races.
Yes, he did. And then he met a man that was called Burr Scott. Scott took Earl with him to ride on state tracks. And by 1917, Sandy was at the big town of Prescott, Arizona, getting $20 a month.
Joe, how did he get to the big time?
Well, Earl saved $200, and he wangled an introduction to Joseph T. Goodman and went to the fairgrounds in New Orleans in the fall of 1917. At that time, he weighed 100 pounds even. Mr. Goodman put Earl to work as a stable boy and used him to gallop horses. And that, of course, was Earl Sandy's real beginning with real horses. His pay then, $20 a month, plus his clothes.
Not much of a start. What happened after that, Joe?
Well, the next year, 1918, saw his contract being sold to Johnson and Kane. And later that same year, the contract was sold to Commander J.K.L. Ross for $16,000. Of course, that was real money and a lot of money. But Sandy wasn't getting it, Ray.
He actually rode for Ross, didn't he?
Yes, he did, under trainer H.G. Bedwell. He started to gallop the horses, soon had his own mounts. And in 1919, in seven races at Havre de Grace, he had six winners. A good trick any time you can do it. In 1920, he rode 17 stake winners, so Sandy was doing pretty much okay.
Well, what broke up that relationship?
Well, you remember Commander Ross owned Sir Barton.
Yeah, the same Sir Barton who ran against Man of War and got his heart broken.
That's right. But Ross picked Frankie Fields to ride in place of Earl Sandy. And Sandy asked for the cancellation of his contract.
Why didn't Ross want him to ride?
Well, Commander Ross said that he was going in an unlucky streak. Not Sandy, but Ross. And he hoped for better luck, and so changed riders.
How'd Sandy feel about it?
It was all broken up, Ray. He says it was the low point of his career. It also happened to be the turning point of Earl Sandy's career. Because the famous Rancocas Stables in those days signed him for $15,000. And that was just 20 times more than what Ross was paying him. In 1923, Sandy was the big money winner. And over a period of 10 years, he rode just about every great horse, including Man of War.
How often did he ride Man of War?
Well, that was just once. Earl says that Big Red was the greatest horse of them all. Mr. Riddle, in this one particular race, told him to just gallop the horse around. Earl did. The horse was moving very beautifully, and at the head of the stretch, Earl couldn't resist the temptation to just kind of cluck a little bit to him. As you know, Sandy sometimes sang to them, but this time he just clucked a little bit. And the big horse took off and, believe it or not, equaled the track record.
What's Sandy doing today, Joe?
Well, Sandy, as you know, has been training his own horses. He has a very promising yearling right now at Belmont Park. And so Earl Sandy is out to the track often. Feels good, looks good, could ride tomorrow. And you know, Damon Runyon wrote a poem about Sandy. Wrote it in the press box at Louisville in 1930 after Earl had won the Kentucky Derby on Gallant Fox by two lengths going away.
Say, have they turned the pages back to the past once more? Back to the racing ages? And a derby out of the yore? Say, don't tell me I'm daffy. Ain't that the same old grin? Why, it's that handy guy named Sandy, booting a winner in. Say, don't tell me I'm batty. Say, don't tell me I'm blind. Look at that seat, so natty. Look how he drives from behind. Gone is the white of the Ranco and the white band under his chin. Still, he's that handy guy named Sandy, booting a winner in. Maybe he ain't no chicken. Maybe he's getting along. But the old heart's still a-tickin', and the old bean's gone strong. Roll back the years, yay, roll 'em. Say, but I'm young again. Watching that handy guy named Sandy, booting a winner in.
The All-American Sports Show is written by Jack C. Wilson, produced and directed by Dan Sutter, with music by Paul Taubman. Ted Atkinson was played by Richard Holland, and this is Ray Barrett speaking. This has been an NBC Radio Network production.
Saturdays, listen to New Talent USA on NBC.